Footsteps to Enchantment, the 17th of September 2023. Yesterday I received a really lovely, very long email from one of my former PhD students and now friend, Justin Green Russell. She'd been reading several of my books, including Letters to Lily and Enchantment and Modernity, and was apparently swept away by them because they echoed her own search and feelings through her life and exploded in her mind, as she put it. This set me thinking, because she saw, as a very intelligent reader, the two of the most important general messages from these works and my book on Japan and elsewhere. One is that we can reconcile rationality and enchantment, that we don't have to choose one or the other, as we are often taught. The second is that most of the world, instead of assuming that we have found the answer, which is rationality, and the rest of the world will catch up, most of the world doesn't believe that there is a binary choice between the two, and most of the world lives much of its life in enchantment. Once you get outside what I call the Anglosphere, Britain and its empire and America, then much of life is enchanted. That's one message of the book she was reading. The second is that our particular solution, which is the scientific revolution, the Renaissance, and so on, is not predestined, inevitable march of progress, etc. It is, in fact, a giant accident. A whole lot of things had to happen. She puts many of them down to technologies like printing and glass, but also social institutions like trusts, and these are indeed very important, and there are others. So it was an accidental outcome against all the odds that we should end up with our kind of industrial scientific civilization. And those are indeed two of the major things that I have discovered over my lifetime. And this set me thinking overnight about whether it would be possible or fun to bring together a number of my thoughts and writings on the area of enchantment throughout my life, and putting them together in some kind of reader or volume for others to enjoy if they wanted. So it would be the background to the particular books, and it would give an idea of the way in which I meandered through my life to where I am now. Now, in a way, I've done bits of it in my book on Enchantment and Modernity, but that doesn't contain the details and in-depth attempts to move from step to step along this path. So thinking about how one might approach this, and it's probably only something I could do with Justin's help if she was interested, here are a few of the stepping stones as I see them now on this beautiful September morning. The first would be from my first infancy in India, something from my book called India, Beginnings and Endings, which is about the influence of Assam and India and my mother on rearing me in an enchanted world, the world of Rudyard Kipling and Mowgli and so on. Maybe there's something in that volume which is relevant. Then I came back to England, and there are various passages, both in my description of my home life, Dorset days, life in a Dorset house on the edge of Thomas Hardy's Egdon Heath, and the magic of that period between 6 and 12 when I was back in England. Also, perhaps even in the account of my boarding school, Dragon Days, Becoming a Dragon, which recounts some of those moments when you encounter what I later realized was enchantment, music, friendship, acting, games, all sorts of things. We were being inculcated into various, what I later call, bubbles of enchantment. In fact, much of my school life was a training, now I realize, in how to access enchantment. I haven't defined enchantment so far, and obviously that will be needed at an early point, but roughly I'm meaning a sort of magic which arises from being outside the normal rules and constraints of rational life, out of space, out of time, in another parallel universe, which is roughly what Durkheim, for example, describes sacred as against profane space. So a state of liminality outside, which can be achieved through all sorts of different ways. Then I went on to the Lake District, and there's bits in both my booklet of home life, Lakeland Life, where I describe growing up in William Wordsworth's Valley in Eswate Dale, the enchantment of discovering poetry and the mountains and fishing, and that world which filled me with a sense of something that Wordsworth writes about, but also my school life in the Yorkshire Moors, where there was a continuation of training in enchantment, becoming engrossed in English poetry and literature, growing friendships, games, and fishing, and other things. So there are essays there and other things which are relevant. Then there would be some extracts from the next stage, which was Oxford as an undergraduate, particularly love, because there I had my first love affair, a very, very enchanted love affair with a young Hungarian girl. And she kept a sort of diary of it, and I kept it, and we've got our letters to each other and my love letters to my next girlfriend at Oxford. They're all in Oxford undergraduate. And so there are quite a lot of moments of enchantment there. But also it's got a really good account of disenchantment, of rationality, of the awareness that I was being taught that the world is not a wondrous, enchanted, magical place, but that it is grey, confused, there are no absolutes, that we have to separate different parts of our lives. And this is particularly caught in a very long essay in my beginning of my third year on Victorianism, which is a study of how the Victorians, Tennyson and Arnold and all these people, faced up to the meaninglessness and disenchanted nature of life, the loss of religion and the loss of certainty, and having to balance evils against each other. So that is an exploration just at the time when I was losing my Christian certainties of disenchantment. Then the next volume is the beginnings of a search for another kind of resolution to the questions of how we became disenchanted. So it's a study. My DPhil at Oxford is on the history of English witchcraft, and with the supervision of Keith Thomas, who was writing his great book on this very theme, Religion and the Decline of Magic, I was studying at a local level the shift from what I took to be a magical, coherent, interfused medieval world to the world of Newton and Bacon and modern science and rationality and leading up to the Enlightenment. So that's an account of that period, and there are various extracts on this very theme there. I then went to the London School of Economics, and there was another important stepping stone, which was to learn something in more depth about anthropology, because taught by many of the great generation of anthropologists, I discovered that what I was searching for was to be found to a certain extent in anthropology in two ways. One was that anthropologists dealt with the whole person. They didn't split us into the economic, the political, social, ideological, but they looked at usually small-scale societies and saw how things were interconnected. And this was a restorative to my increasingly disconnected life. And the second was that they dealt with many societies, often, of course, on the periphery, where there was still a great deal of magic and symbolism and belief in a spiritual dimension. In other words, the what T.S. Eliot calls the disassociation of sensibility, the disenchantment of the world had not occurred. So I looked at these societies, and although we assumed they were vanishing and that they were peripheral, there were plenty of them there. For example, in the great work of Levi-Strauss, he documents that world in Amazonia. I then had to choose somewhere to do my anthropological fieldwork. So I went to the Himalayas. I wanted to go back to where my enchanted childhood, as I remembered it, had been. And this was the nearest I could go. And I had a wonderful supervisor who'd worked extensively there, Führer Heimendorf. And so he suggested I went to central Nepal, the Annapurna Mountains, people called the Gurungs. And when I arrived, I discovered, to my amazement, not having really thought about it, that I had found an enchanted society. It was as described in my various writings, which bits of which I can use. It was filled with spirits. The village was filled with ancestors and little godlings and witches and forest demons, all sorts of things. So the material physical world was alive with something else. It was like children's stories. There was magic everywhere. And I went to shamanic trances and events and strange funerals and all sorts of things. And so I re-encountered and experienced personally, and continued to do so, though to a decreasing degree as the villagers moved out, a world over a period now of 50 years of a mountain village shamanic universe. When I came back, I taught anthropology and continued my studies of the English. And there was another very important break, which was when I, in 1977, sat down and wrote a short book on the outlines of English history called The Origins of English Individualism. Why that was important was that it showed the deep roots of my disenchantment, because it attacked the myth of Marx, Weber and sociologists that the English had been, as everyone else was, deeply enchanted until the Protestant Reformation or a little earlier, and then they had become Protestants and rational and enlightened and so on. And my work on English villages with Sarah, my wife, showed that this was a myth being created by people who didn't really know about how life worked. And there was huge continuity in a disenchanted kind of way of looking at things, which derived from the very early roots of English individualism and capitalism, which set England apart from the continent increasingly, and was then exported to America. So that was a big clearing away operation, 1977-8. And I continued to do that in a number of different books later on. The next big milestone, I think, was probably going to Japan in 1990, finding a very modern, technologically sophisticated urban society, being a little disappointed at first, but gradually finding that there was something else lurking there, just shimmering out occasionally. And increasingly in discussions with my close Japanese friends and in a number of visits there, I began to sense that Japan on the surface was disenchanted and rational and modern and separated, but its deep lair was a continued ancient shamanic enchantment, and it had not separated out the world at all. And I can document this from various diaries, accounts, this discovery, because I've written a book called Discovering Japan, which tells the story of the lead up to my book on Japan, Japan Through the Looking Glass. And then the next step was going to China in 1996. Not that first visit, extraordinary though it was, but then the return in 2002 and another 16 visits almost yearly until COVID, where I had the same experience as I had in Japan, which is that the surface, particularly now, is a galloping modernization at the material and technological, social level, but behind it, a whole world which has been maintained for thousands of years of Taoist, Buddhist, ancestor worshipping, and a belief in forces of nature which are not separated off from us, that we are part of them, a bit like the Gaia hypothesis and so on. And this was an extreme shock, because China cannot be ignored. It's a quarter of the world, or fifth of the world in population and area, and combined with other East Asian countries, Burma, Japan, and so on. And then, if you think about it for a moment, India, enchanted, South America, enchanted, much of Africa, spots of Europe. So you begin to see more and more how we live in a strange sort of aberration from the majority of humankind. Those experiences drove home this lesson that I really needed to rethink things, and I became more and more interested in how the West, not just England, developed this disenchanted view, a particular binary vision derived from Greek philosophy and Christianity of separating the two parts, the head and the heart, the mind and the body, right and wrong, left and right, why we had this binary view. And it came into perspective when you placed it against the quantum view of most of humanity, which is a both and view, yin and yang, and each penetrating each other. And so I began to dig deeper into all of this. And one or two stepping stones, and others will emerge as I think about it, on that journey. One was a little bit before I wrote Enchantment and Modernity. In the first or second year of COVID, lockdown, unable to more or less go out of the house, I was contacted by a philosopher, Richard Marshall, who was again deeply interested in my question. He'd been a pupil of Ernest Gellner, the philosopher, for a year, and he'd done a degree in ambiguity in philosophy, and he was also a very skillful headmaster in a London difficult school. And he wanted to interview me, and what started in an hour or an hour and a half's interview ended up with 35 hours of conversations around the themes of enchantment, magic, the East and the West, China, the origins of English individualism, everything. And that book has just been published as a book called Understandings of the Modern World, Conversations in a Time of COVID with Richard. And there are sections there where I'm working out, because they were just, he asked me a question of a philosophical kind or historical kind or anthropological kind, and I just had to ad lib, invent an answer. So I was exploring in my mind things I hadn't really worked out or thought about in answer to a very intelligent questioner who knew my work well. So that's where I went very fast along a path or over footsteps towards a new integration of my thought. And after writing that or talking about that, I thought, having written 10 volumes of my detailed autobiography, which was absolutely necessary to get me where I am, because I had to understand myself and how my life had gone through from a sort of enchantment to disenchantment and back again. Once I'd written that, I realized I needed to analyze it anthropologically, do an anthropological analysis. So the Enchantment book was a volume of the first volume of analysis. Another, the subsequent next one, was when I thought, well, I've traced the journey in terms of my experiences at school and college and as an anthropologist, but I need to retrace the journey in my mind. And I took the title of a book that Descartes had originally intended to call his Discourse on Method, which was A History of My Mind. So I wrote A History of My Mind. That is, I went through my life looking at different points at which I'd started on a theme. It might be on population or the family or economic growth or whatever it was. And I traced from the first time I think I thought about that, sometimes at school, sometimes at university, and then how my thought progressed through my life up to the present. And a number of the last sections are about binary and quantum thinking and enchantment and these sorts of themes, so there will be material there. And so the story went on. And one last stepping stone I'll mention, because it's recent and intriguing. January of this year, I was asked to, at short notice, to interview a famous Chinese artist and a man called Tim Yip came into my room with his life-size 17-year-old porcelain doll, dressed doll called Lily, and I started to talk to him. And as I did, I began to realize he was a wonderful way into the enchantment of China. As an artist, a photographer, a designer, a painter, a choreographer, a museum curator, a polymath, with an enchanted vision of the world. His mother was a Buddhist. He was someone who, as an artist, saw the world in a totally different way. When he looked at a piece of wood, he didn't see the wood, he saw the forest from which the wood came. He looked down and saw us and people in a strange and different light. Not only did he see it, but he managed to communicate it in an extraordinary way. He was most famous for winning an Oscar for many of the concepts and the designs for an extraordinarily enchanted film called Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, about Qin martial arts and so on. But he'd done many other art works in forms of films and exhibitions and drawings, and constantly doing that. Recently, for example, doing the settings and much of the concepts for Wagner's Lohengrin at the Met, and exhibitions at the British Museum and Minneapolis and so on. And he managed to, amazingly, as artists try to do, bring up from his subconscious his alternative vision of our world. So he gave an enchanted view. And so I said, why don't we have a longer conversation, which we did for about 6 or 8 hours. And it's just been published as a book called Wonder and Art. And there are bits of that where he or I talk about all this matters. So although it looks in many ways similar to an outline of my book on enchantment, and it does follow the same chronological sequence of discovery as a path through time, it might be interesting to include not my later reflections, which is what is in enchantment, but a set of readings of the various stages, so people can see at the time what I thought as I was becoming disenchanted or went to Japan or whatever it is. Not too much, but just enough, with some commentary, which, if Justin was interested to add some of the commentary as an outsider, would enrich it, or by myself. In some ways, it's a parallel to a book I wrote just for interest recently called My Political Education, which did the same thing for the growth of my political consciousness and how I learnt about the political world. And what started as a very small book ended up as a book of readings and reflections with bits from my diary. And that also might be an interesting thing, because Sarah and I have kept a detailed diary since 1978, and I have also a very full, what I call, great thoughts book, where I write down ideas at greater length when they first come to me. So there will be materials there. There may be materials in emails or elsewhere. So it would be a set of musings on enchantment. No particular purpose, no particular time frame, just meditations on enchantment and how we can restore our world, because I haven't talked here about my final discovery of the way in which we enchant our lives or continue to enchant our lives. And that's something all this has been stimulated by Justin Green Russell's very kind email.